From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Last weekend in Tripoli, a raid on the hideout of suspected bank robbers turned into a week-long battle between Islamist militants and the Lebanese army. It occurred mostly on the outskirts of the Palestinian refugee camp where the militants are based, and the army is not permitted to enter. Dozens of combatants and civilians have been killed. The militant group is called Fatah al-Islam, founded last year as an offshoot of a Syrian-backed Palestinian faction.
That much we know, but as is so often the case in the land of cedars, the rest of the who, what, and why of this story is murky. The Lebanese government says that Syria is behind the militants and that Damascus timed the assault to coincide with the Security Council's deliberations on a tribunal for the assassins of former Lebanese Prime Minister Rafik Hariri. But Fatah al-Islam denies any connection to Syria. We called Habib Battah, managing editor of the Journal of Middle East Broadcasters in Beirut, to find out how the story is being told on Lebanese TV. Habib, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks very much.
So the Lebanese government has been insisting all along that Fatah al-Islam is backed by Syria. Is this account being picked up by the TV stations you've been watching?
It depends on which channel you're watching, because the Lebanese TV is dominated by political parties. Now, the Syrian connection is very controversial here. Some channels will just go ahead and play that, which plays into the pro-American government of Lebanon. On the channels that are supportive of Hezbollah and other Lebanese opposition channels, you won't see that claim played up so much. So, you know, you really have to watch all the Lebanese channels to get all the points of view, which is different than in America, for example, where, you know, the local evening news on channels 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 or whatever pretty much have the same stories with different camera angles and, you know, a different kicker.
3 months ago, the New Yorker magazine ran a piece by investigative journalist Seymour Hersh that included an alternative version of events. He said that Fatah al-Islam was among several Sunni militant groups being covertly backed by the American, Lebanese, and Saudi governments in an attempt to counter the growing influence of Hezbollah, which is obviously a Shiite militia. Very little, if any, of the reporting here in the States has picked up that storyline. What about where you are?
That has been picked up. Al-Manar is very much likes to play analyst who quotes Seymour Hersh. Hezbollah backs the channel. The pro-government channels obviously won't tell that story.
A lot of the reporting here has also focused on the connection, or at least the sympathies, between Fatah al-Islam and al-Qaeda. Is that being dwelled on over there, or do you think this is just an American storyline?
No, that's definitely a convenient storyline for the Bush administration and its looming confrontation, it seems, with Syria. But, you know, at this point, it's very difficult to say where these groups really come from. The only evidence so far has been presented, it's been circumstantial evidence, is that they are Syrian-backed and that Damascus stands to gain the most from stopping the international tribunal. Then again, other channels are very critical of the Lebanese government. They say the Lebanese government is at fault here because they haven't taken action to disarm these camps. One of the main questions that's not tackled by the American media here, and the Lebanese media for a lot of reasons, is why there is this hatred in these camps, and why do these camps exist? Why do we have 350,000 people living in Lebanon in these tight conditions? You know, everything is broken, everything is polluted, and it's like growing up in a prison, basically, because you can't own property outside the camp, you can't really work outside the camp, so you're confined to the camp. You know, it's a really hopeless reality to be in these camps.
But these are long-standing conditions, Habib, and what we have here is a breaking story about a new group that seemed to come from elsewhere and just planted themselves near the camps because this was a lawless area where the Lebanese militia wasn't likely to be able to get at them.
That's definitely true, but I do believe that the reason that these lawless areas exist, these pockets of lawlessness, is really part of a bigger question as to, you know, what is the big event half a century ago that created these camps, not just in Lebanon, but across the Middle East.
You're talking about the creation of Israel.
Well, I'm talking about the refugee crisis that followed the creation of Israel, where, you know, some 700,000 Palestinians were made homeless. They were never made citizens in Lebanon because that has inflamed tensions in the country to the point where we had a civil war over it. And the Lebanese army, after a civil war, decided that raiding these camps would be detrimental to the future of the country. So it's the camps, you know, they're really a beehive of anger and hostility And they really need to be addressed in the media, I think, in a more thorough context, because even if this group is wiped out, there will be other groups if the situation and the conditions persist in these camps.
Habib, thank you very much.
No problem. Thank you.
Habib Bataa is managing editor of the Journal of Middle East Broadcasters. He spoke to us from Beirut.
It isn't easy to be Al Hura, the U.S.-produced Arabic-language satellite channel. For one thing, there's lots of competition, Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya being right at the top of the list. Then there's the sponsor problem. Why would anyone tune into something that's explicitly U.S. propaganda? Which gets to the biggest problem. Nobody, to speak of, is tuning in. So, in recent months, under new editorial management, Al Hura has tried to be a more relevant source of information for the Arab-speaking audience. And the result? The Congress, which picks up the $60 million a year tab, is not happy with the kind of journalism the station is airing. Mark Lynch is Associate Professor of Political Science at George Washington University and the blogger behind AbuAardvark.com. He joins us once again. Mark, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So, new editorial management, a guy named Larry Register, formerly of CNN. How long has he been there? What has he done differently?
They tried to maybe diversify some of the guest lists and try to cover issues more relevant to Arab audiences and to try and be more competitive. One of their really good ideas was to pretty dramatically increase the amount of coverage of American politics, for instance. So that's the one place where they have a real competitive advantage. They can actually get access to American politics in much more depth than, say, Al Jazeera can.
But in the quest for relevance, they also committed a couple of blunders. A lot of people in Congress very upset about these. Tell me about them.
One was coverage of the Holocaust conference in Iran. Another was the airing of a speech by Hassan Nasrallah, who's the leader of Hezbollah, and a couple of other incidents. And I think that these have then been used to cast aspersions upon the entire programming of the station, which I think is a bit unfair. One of the biggest problems with Al Hura has always been that there's no real ability for anyone to effectively monitor what's going on the station. The feed doesn't broadcast in the United States. You can't get access to it over the internet. They don't publish transcripts in English or in Arabic. And what this means is that nobody is really in a position to assess it, including the top executives there. Register himself, of course, doesn't speak Arabic. And so what this means is that when the Wall Street Journal's editorial page decides to take an example like Nasrallah's speech and use it to tarnish Al Hura, it's very difficult for anybody to know whether or not that's really representative of what the station is doing.
I must say that, you know, when I read these Wall Street Journal op-eds, I was kind of stunned by some of the language that the Al Hura reporters were using at, for example, the Holocaust Denial Conference, which seemed at least implicitly to accept that there's some sort of historical controversy here. You have to think that if Larry Register spoke Arabic, that that language would not have been permitted on the air.
Yeah, the Holocaust Denial Conference coverage appears to have been a mistake. And as I understand it, some people have been fired over it. The airing of Hassan Nasrallah's speech, I think, is less of a mistake in that Nasrallah is the head of a major political movement in Lebanon, and every other television station in the region was covering that speech. Right when Al Hura was launched, there was a huge controversy over the fact that it failed to cover the assassination of a senior Hamas leader. And this was taken immediately as evidence that it was not a credible news organization, because people in the region who are switching channels constantly, if they go from Al Jazeera showing Nasrallah to Al Arabiya showing Nasrallah to Al Hura showing inside the actor's studio, it sends a pretty powerful message.
I want to get back to the transparency issue, the fact that nobody has access to transcripts in Arabic or in English, much less the broadcasts themselves. Now, $60 million is a pretty good chunk of change. Is it money that is keeping the Congress and the State Department and others from having access to what's actually aired on the station they're paying for?
The reason that's usually given is that there's actually a law, the Smith-Mundt Act, against the domestic dissemination of foreign propaganda. Since Al Hura is technically foreign propaganda, it would be against the law to disseminate it in the United States. What's funny is that Radio Sawa, which is the Arabic language radio station that we fund for the same purpose, for public diplomacy, has a live web feed that you can listen to Radio Sawa online anytime you want. So there's a bit of a double standard there. I always had the impression, based on my own experiences, that there was more of a control issue, that Al-Hurra's management, especially under the former regime, was extremely concerned about protecting its own image in Washington.
The law, I guess, is grounded in the idea that foreign propaganda could be, dishonest, and that if it were to blow back to the states, then the U.S. government would actually be telling official lies to its own people. But is Smith-Mundt in the digital world now, not kind of obsolete?
I think it's pretty irrelevant in today's day and age. I mean, just to give you an example, one of the very rare scoops that Al-Hurra has gotten was they were interviewing a member of the Iraqi parliament when the parliament building was bombed. So they happened to have live footage. Almost immediately, there was a clip of that up on YouTube. The clip was picked up and rebroadcast by a whole range of other news organizations. And the fact that it was on Al-Hurra didn't even slow it down in terms of being disseminated back into the United States.
Mark, as always, thanks so much.
Well, thanks for having me.
Mark Lynch is packing his bags at Williams College for a new position at George Washington University's Elliott School of International Affairs. He blogs at abuardvark.com.
Coming up, a photojournalist accepts the Pulitzer he was awarded 27 years ago and the perils of living online.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is a podcast break, so I know I'm talking to the time shifters out there. And so allow me to recommend another podcast, Radiolab. It's deliciously weird and brainy, and it's full of sound, handcrafted by Jad Abumrad and Robert Krulwich, kind of fire and ice. The new season begins this weekend, and saying it's about science doesn't even begin to describe it. I would seriously urge you to check out Radiolab, even if it weren't produced by WNYC. But it is. Oh, and you can find the podcast for Radiolab on iTunes or at radiolab.org. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. In the 90-year history of the Pulitzer Prizes, only one has been awarded anonymously, the 1980 winner in Spot News Photography. That photograph, called Firing Squad in Iran, is a black-and-white image of the court-ordered execution of 11 Kurdish men in Sanadaj, Iran, in August of 1979. The photo was taken exactly as the executioners fired their rifles, capturing a moment between life and death. It ran on front pages around the world, a rare glimpse of the violence perpetrated by Iran's post-revolutionary regime. The photographer, worried for his safety, remained anonymous until last December when he revealed himself to a Wall Street Journal reporter named Josh Prager. His name, now known around the world, is Jahangir Razmi, and this week he traveled to New York to accept his Pulitzer 27 years after the fact. Jahangir doesn't take photos of executions any longer. He snaps portraits now, mostly of brides in Tehran. He joined us on Monday to talk about the effect of this photograph on his life and why he remained anonymous for so long.
I just didn't want to stir up tensions in society once again, and so I waited and wanted the matter to remain quiet. And during this time, many people took credit for this photo. Some of them were my friends. It was when Mr. Josh Prager traveled to Iran with the permission of the Islamic Republic and the Ministry of Culture that I agreed to talk with him. He seemed at the time, and it turned out to be, very trustworthy, and I turned over the original photos to Josh. Had Josh not traveled to Iran and found me, I may never have come forward.
Obviously, you captured an extraordinary moment, a historic moment, and obviously you got the greatest recognition that journalism gives to photographers. And you also witnessed something dreadful. How has this moment affected your life?
At the moment of the execution, while the prisoners were lined up and after they were shot, I was only paying attention to the technical aspects of my work, to the speed of the camera, and I was thinking of how I could capture that scene. It was only after I saw the picture on the front page of the newspaper that I'd realized what I'd done. The effect on me, covering this execution, the executions before the revolution, at the beginning of the revolution, other things I'd witnessed in Kurdistan and the Iran-Iraq war, and there was a war following all of this, it affected me terribly. It left me in a state where I didn't have the desire to work anymore. I was devastated emotionally. I really couldn't continue to work without addressing these issues. But my employers just wanted me to go on doing my job, and I began to feel like work was meaningless. So I left the newspaper and sort of sidelined myself from the journalistic community, and I gained some solace after I did that.
Now that you have been named as the author of the Pulitzer-winning photograph, do you have any desire again to return to journalism?
No, I have no desire whatsoever to work for Iranian newspapers. If I decide to go back to journalism, I would want to work for foreign news agencies.
The current regime is, by our standards, quite reactionary. Yet you are here, I presume, with the government's knowledge and permission. Has this acknowledgement of the work you did 27 years ago created any risk for you personally?
Well, no, luckily. Until now, I've not been in any danger, and I'm hopeful that from here on out, I will continue to be safe, because this government is very different from the government that existed 27 years ago. And there are laws now, and they've reached a place where they'll consider the law when it comes to dealing with situations like this one.
Jahangir, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
27 years after winning the Pulitzer for Spot News Photography, Jahangir Razmi accepted his prize at the Pulitzer Luncheon in New York City this week. We might never have known his name had it not been for the Wall Street Journal reporter Josh Prager. Josh has a pretty fascinating beat. He writes about secrets. The quest that took him to Iran in search of the secret photographer was inspired when he was on vacation, casually flipping through a book called Moments.
It was a book of all the Pulitzer Prize-winning photographs, and when I turned to 1980, one very large word in bold letters caught my eye. The word was anonymous, and that made me very much want to find out who this person was, because I figured he or she, Iranian or American, had a story to tell.
Now, in the course of your reporting, you actually spoke to at least a couple of the people who, over the last 27 years, variously, had claimed to have taken this series of photos. Those must have been some awkward interviews.
Yes, they were difficult interviews. The only reason it was even relevant to the story is because it was one of the real motivating factors that led Mr. Razmi to come forward. He is a very humble man. He's an unbelievably patient man. And yet it really gnawed at him that other people had taken credit for his work. And his sons, they had for some time urged him to come forward, but he did not, because there was a real fear that he had lived with for all of these years, almost from the day after he took the photograph. The government, as this photograph was getting passed all about, it was getting Xeroxed and copied and tacked all about Tehran, the government did something very dramatic. They simply appropriated Etelaat. They just took over the newspaper. So Mr. Razmi was well aware of the incredible repercussions of this one click of his shutter. When he then learned that he won the Pulitzer Prize, it was simply told him quietly in the Etelat newsroom. As he said to me, I didn't have the guts to celebrate.
When you first went to Tehran to dig around here, you clearly had to be invited by some official agency. How delicately did you have to dance around the facts in order to get access to the people you needed to get access to?
It was quite tricky. I did not mention that I wanted to write about this photograph, and that I wanted to meet Mr. Razmi. What I said was I wanted to write about Iranian photojournalism. There are an enormous number of really talented photographers in Iran, and it was this small fraternity of top photographers who knew Mr. Razmi's identity and wanted him to be able to get his recognition after all these years.
We're speaking with you on Monday, the day that Mr. Razmi actually accepted, belatedly, his Pulitzer. I wonder if you've been in touch with the families of the victims of the shooting 27 years ago for their reaction to the events as they've unfolded.
I'm not only in touch, they're here as well. Two of the 11 people who were killed that day were brothers, Hassan and Shariar Nahid, and their mother and sister live in Los Angeles, Roya and Monir, and they have always wanted to know who took this picture because they felt that the picture helped their sons live on, that their death had served a higher purpose in making the world realize what was going on in their country, and they always felt indebted to this anonymous photographer. And so Roya and Monir flew in from Los Angeles to New York, and they were also with us at the Pulitzer, sitting at our table. These are people who I met while working on a story, but who have become real friends of mine. And so this, I've never felt more exhilarated in all my life to be a journalist.
Well, Josh, congratulations to you as well.
Thank you very much.
Josh Prager is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. He's also the author of a book about another secret, The Echoing Green, the untold story of Bobby Thompson, Ralph Branca, and the shot heard round the world.
Serves many needs, ranging from general research to shopping to, let's face it, snooping. We all know that people use Google to find out about one another. And on MySpace and Facebook, young people have a tendency to tell all. I say young because it's a generational thing. Most of us older people never had the chance to act like, well, kids online, whereas today's 12-year-olds have chronicled their lives in a way that is virtually impossible to erase. For instance, one of our producers, Nazanin Rafsanjani, once wrote a letter, an email actually, to a website called www.iranian.com. She's here to tell the tale. Nazanin, welcome to this side of the microphone.
Thank you.
Now, you were 19 when you wrote this letter. It was in response to America's response to 9/11. You wrote it in 2001. Can you read the portion of it that I highlighted?
Yeah. Okay, so I hate this American reaction, and yet where else would I feel safe writing these words? Not in Iran, so where do my loyalties lie? They lie with the Americans who have died in this tragedy. They lie with the Afghanis who will die in its wake. I will not be pressured to rally behind a government that kills in the name of democracy, and I reject the one that oppresses in the name of Islam. My loyalties lie with innocence, and that is where they belong.
So why did you find that embarrassing?
I don't have this desire to get my feelings out into the world, and it's just the only time that I did this, and had I known at the time that I'd be talking about it 6 years later, I never would have done it. And, you know, I realize that in the grand scheme of the things that could be on the internet, it may seem ridiculous that I care about a letter like this, but reading it now, it just sounds so, you know, serious.
It was a serious time, and you were a teenager.
It was, it's true.
Have you tried to get it removed from www.iranian.com?
Yes, I did try to get it removed. And partly that was because I was embarrassed about it. But partly it was because I was going to Iran. And in the other parts of the email, I say some things about the Iranian government. And I wrote a letter to the publisher of the site, and I asked for it to be removed. And he wrote me back and said everything on Iranian.com is permanent. And I understood that. But after he said that, it dawned on me that I can't get rid of it no matter what I do.
And it didn't occur to you when you sent that letter that, you know, it was going to be out there? You weren't sending a personal letter on paper. You were sending it to a public forum.
I really thought it was going to be up there for a week or something, and that it would just sort of disappear or keep going down the list of things that I had done, but it won't. It comes up really high.
And we've established that you really are a private person. So I'm just wondering, how come you're talking about it right now? Aren't you just drawing more attention to it?
I do generally ignore it, but I feel like I might as well just face it head on. Maybe this interview will come up close to that, close to the letter when people Google me or something. By doing this, I feel like I am affecting it or controlling it a little bit.
Nazanin, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Nazanin Rafsanjani is a producer for On the Media, and hers is an increasingly common problem. For a solution, or at least some perspective, we turn now to Emily Nussbaum, who wrote about the phenomenon of life online for New York Magazine. Emily, welcome back to the show.
Hello.
So how is this different, really, from the experience of every young person from the beginning of time who say and do things that they may later regret?
To me, it's very different. A researcher that I interviewed, Dana Boyd, had characterized online communications as differing from offline communications in these four specific ways. She talked about the fact that there's something called chronological asynchrony, which basically means you could write something in 1999 and somebody could see it and comment on it in 2004. Everything that you put out there is linked to every other thing, and you can't predict how much it will be linked. It's searchable, and you don't know who's looking at it. She called it invisible audiences. And I think that this is the biggest paranoia-building aspect of this, is that you just have the sense that something is floating out there, and you don't know who searched for it. And that's just not been true in the past when it comes to embarrassing experiences. The furthest it's probably going to go is the edges of town.
And when you were writing your piece, you ran into people who weren't only trying to fix their own mistakes, but the mistakes other people made in statements said about them. And that's, I guess, is just as hard to get rid of.
That's true. I mean, there are people who certainly are extremely upset about stuff people have said about them online. And that is an experience for people of all ages. But the one thing that I did find with younger people was a lot of people had been through that sort of online melodrama when they were 15 or 16. And they'd had this one experience where they had gotten into a fight online. They'd written a bunch of passive aggressive comments back and forth, and it blew up into this huge thing. And it lasted a couple of months, and they cried and were very upset. But it happened that one time, and in a strange way, it acted almost like a vaccine that prevented them from necessarily being so enraged, so upset, so bothered by stuff in the future. One person that I interviewed had somebody write something unbelievably nasty on an anonymous college blog, and she and her friend basically looked at it and thought, huh, I wonder why people think that we're, coked out party whores or whatever they had written about her. And she kind of looked at her profile and thought about it. And, she said that it stung for a minute, but it just wasn't that big a deal. I think that's really unusual.
And you've said that this is the biggest generation gap in 50 years, ever since rock and roll. And so is it that relationship with your own public face that makes the generations different? I don't mean just between people 15 and 50, but between people 15 and 25.
Yes, I actually do think that that particular reaction, the one of being stung for a moment, but basically being like, hey, well, that's just something somebody's saying about me. That is something that seems specific to me, to people who've grown up with the internet and have come to regard it just as part of their identity, as part of their self. People who are older often feel just much more thrown for a loop by stuff about them being out in public. They feel more humiliated, more out of control. Although I think those feelings are understandable, in a way they're just a dead end because young people, not in some sort of abstract, knowledgeable way, but just in a gut feeling way, they understand that there is not a place for a lot of privacy anymore. Every time they buy something, it's tracked. Every time they go into the subway, it's tracked. There are cameras everywhere. Every email they sent is stored. They're being documented whether they like it or not. So part of their response to that is just to say, as long as my stuff is going to be out there, I might as well be the one doing it. Every single person that I talked to had at least a Facebook profile. That stuff seems really benign to somebody who's 18. Generally, to somebody who's 50, that is something that seems like an absolutely shocking transgression in publicness.
It's true. We're just not used to living out loud, even those of us who have relatively public lives. I have a wiki entry. And at some point, I checked it and somebody had put in the names of my kids. Mm. And I freaked out. And I went and I tracked it down. And it was posted by a friend of one of my kids at Oberlin who went, all right, I'll take it off. What's your problem? And I realized, yeah, maybe it is my problem. I just don't get it. I don't want their names out there. They have Facebook sites of their own. They're already out there.
I completely identify with your reaction. There is just that, even though it's just a factual thing, like the names of your children, like there's just this sense of like, why should everyone who looks for me know that?
So the CEO of Google, Eric Schmidt, joked that everybody should be able to change their names when they're 21 in order to be able to change their Google hits.
I actually understand why that's an incredibly appealing fantasy, the notion of just erasing one's adolescence. But since it's clearly not truly possible anymore, it might be a really positive social change where people just become more accepting of the fact that these unformed, passionate, mistake-making, weird former selves are floating out there in the universe. I can't say that that will definitely happen, but it would be a good thing.
Emily, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Emily Nussbaum is editor-at-large for New York Magazine. Coming up, a segment some might call pulling back the curtain, and others, too much information.
That's my view. This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org, and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, after Jimmy Carter was quoted as saying that President Bush was the worst president in history, the former president said on the Today Show that his comments were, quote, careless or misinterpreted. The journalist for the Arkansas Democrat Gazette countered back by posting a recording to prove that the quotation was not taken out of context. But journalists aren't the only ones making sure they have a copy of the full interview. An increasing number of interviewees are demanding to have a full transcript to post on their websites should there be a dispute after an article's publication. Jason Calacanis, co-founder of Weblogs, Inc., is one such interviewee. He recently wrote, "Journalists have been burning subjects for so long with paraphrased quotes, half quotes, and misquotes that I think a lot of folks, especially the ones who don't need the press, are taking an email-only interview policy." Jason, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. I'm a big fan.
So do you subscribe to an email-only policy yourself?
I try to do it by email or instant message for both the reason that you stated. It comes out more accurate. I feel like I don't get misquoted, but also because it's more convenient for me when I'm on the road and traveling, and it's more convenient because I can republish the interview in its entirety to my core constituents at my blog and get some content out of it.
Have you been burned by reporters yourself?
I've been burned pretty regularly. I think anybody who's quoted on a regular basis has either been misquoted, half-quoted, generally burned. And I think it has to do in a lot of ways with how journalism has turned into entertainment. A lot of journalists are looking for that gotcha moment. And, you know, having me live on the phone gives them that ability to try to catch me up in something. And I'm not interested in being caught up. I would rather have a really well-thought-out answer. I think journalists are reaping what they've sown, frankly. And if you talk to subjects, they feel like a lot of times journalists are trying to create drama maybe where there isn't drama because they're trying to get ratings. And you know that more than anybody based on the topic of this show.
Obviously, that is a widely held and justified complaint made about the media. But I'm not only the host of this program, I also edit it. We've agreed that you will post the long version of this interview on your site. What our listeners will hear is a short version that was essentially edited down to what I considered to be its most important, most cogent moments.
But I would challenge you to, why wouldn't you publish the full versions for those people who wanted to go in depth? If somebody listened to this and said, you know, I'd really like to hear what those guys said for the full 20, 30, whatever minutes we wound up talking, Why wouldn't you expose your source material? Why wouldn't you expose the email threads? That's my question to you.
I think it's a really good question. And part of it has to do with process. You know, sometimes we will ask a question half a dozen times before the person we're interviewing actually gives us the answer.
The answer that you're looking for?
The answer, the real answer to the question.
You are making the determination that you need the second, third, fourth question. Why can't the audience be intelligent enough to hear all four times you've asked?
Well, I suppose the audience could listen to all four times we ask, but as a former journalist, surely you know that a lot of our job involves asking questions that people don't want to answer but can be convinced to answer over time, and it is our job to act as the reader or listener or viewer surrogate to get the answers that presumably we have to assume that they want. That's why we're in the jobs we're in.
And absolutely, in that circumstance, I agree with you. Asking five times and putting the person on the spot, absolutely, kudos to you. I would like to hear the first four times and hear the person try to skirt the answer. And when journalists say to me, oh, it's process, whatever, that to me sounds like maybe they want to cover their tracks a little bit. Maybe they're afraid of what would happen if the raw transcript came out.
Fair enough. We talk a lot on this show about how the sausage is made, and we have done pieces, actually, about our own editing process. What we'll be doing now will be an exercise in exactly that. But you're right. Sometimes we find that showing the process is actually a distraction.
In your interpretation, it's a distraction. I think that maybe you're underestimating the audience. And I think journalists are a little pretentious in that matter. And perhaps, you know, public radio ones are the most, where they think that their editing ability trumps my ability as a listener to interpret this or understand what you're doing. I'm not an idiot. Give me the raw material.
I want to go back for a moment and defend public radio in general. It certainly isn't the only journalistic medium that uses editors. Every responsible and even irresponsible media organization uses editors because the point is to cull through and provide information in easily digested ways. Now, probably someday all of this stuff will be available in its full and complete form.
I'm not objecting to you, editing. I'm not objecting to you editing it. I am a fan of the show, and I love the way you edit it, in fact. And I wouldn't want a 17-hour version of a topic. But in some cases, I'd like the source material. And that's really my point is, if we all start providing the source material, then you could take an interview from another radio network where they didn't use a piece of it. And maybe you'd say, you know what? Calacanis said something that contradicts what he said in this interview. I'm going to play that for him. And we could have this whole Creative Commons archive of information and greater understanding. And I think journalists need to understand that they're not in control of the process anymore.
Now, this discussion we've had has gone on for about 15 minutes. We will edit this down to about 5 minutes tops. I can't remember a single time where anybody we've interviewed has ever complained, but I would be really interested in reading a brief letter in full in a week if you don't like what we did with it.
You know what? I trust you, so that's the only reason I would have even come here. I would do the interview with or without you guys giving me the MP3 file to publish, because at the end of the day, you earn the trust that people have in you, and I think you guys do a great job of earning the trust.
Jason, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Jason Calacanis is co-founder of Weblogs, Inc., and entrepreneur in residence at the venture capital firm Sequoia Capital. You can find a link at onthemedia.org to Jason's blog, where he'll post unedited versions of our email and audio interview.
You just heard Brooke allude to a story we ran a couple of years ago about how and how much we edit what you hear on our show. It was the brainchild of one of our reporters, John Solomon, who suggested that there were aspects of the process here at On the Media that might interest our listeners. In fact, he thought that some of these methods, used throughout public radio, would come as much of a surprise to them as they did to him. In the spirit of ever-increasing transparency and our growing awareness that we are losing control of our material whether we like it or not, we offer this replay. A warning, those who prefer not to peek behind the curtain should turn down the volume for about the next 10 minutes.
Before I started working at On the Media, I was an avid NPR news listener. To me, like many devotees, an important aspect of the network's appeal is how smooth, well-crafted, and polished it sounds. Everyone seems so eloquent. Interviewers ready with a clearly posed, on-point question. Interviewees offering an articulate answer. Rarely an or you know uttered. Correspondents in the field, even when reporting from the middle of the rainforest, are equally cogent and coherent. And hosts move naturally, effortlessly, and spontaneously between stories. That soothing and reliable sound has made the NPR product distinctive from other radio and news media.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Bloch.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Next, the rule of law in Russia.
Tips for senators on how to survive.
Now that I am on the other side of the speaker, it has been fascinating to discover the importance of behind-the-scenes technical packaging in bringing about that effect. Of course, I want to make it clear that I have found the NPR News on-air staff, present company excluded, is indeed smooth and eloquent and normally ask the right question. But they, and now me, aren't as perfect as it once seemed. New York Times media reporter David Carr.
Everybody always sounds erudite and witty on NPR, and I've always wondered why, and I think there probably is some darkroom magic going on there.
My exposure to the darkroom began when I edited my first story. I sat at the digital editing console with a producer listening to an interview with a source I had recorded earlier. With just strokes of the keyboard, he cleaned up and tightened the sound bites I was going to use, taking out sentences, words, and even some of the pauses, making what are called internal edits. Then the various thoughts were woven together technically in a way that would be totally hidden to the listener. In fact, the public is far less aware of editing on radio than on television or in print. For example, to eliminate words, a TV producer has to use more visible means, such as a cutaway shot or jump cut. Newspaper reporters, by form, must put a break between non-consecutive quotations, among other constraints. David Carr says that at the Times,
people have to speak in complete sentences or you don't use it.
NPR interview subjects almost never complain about the slicing and dicing, in large part because the edits make them sound more articulate without changing the meaning. In fact, what David Carr actually said on tape was,
people have to speak in complete sentences or you don't use it.
While many public radio programs, particularly call-in shows, are live, I was surprised to find out that newsmaker interviews for the daily NPR national news shows, Morning Edition and All Things Considered, are often not. Usually they are pre-taped and quickly edited down. Likewise, I was stunned when I learned that the main Fresh Air interview is actually condensed from a longer Q&A. And at times, the Car Talk guys will edit in some extra laughs kept on file.
They will do that, I hear.
Here at On the Media, we do even more editing because as a weekly show, we have more time. It helps make us sound far more articulate than we actually are. For example, here's Bob's original question in a recent interview taping with National Journal's Bill Powers.
Now, your column this week says that there's actually a disadvantage to being a front runner because immediately the media want to take you down. That is a very serious charge, really, against the media. How true is it? Are the motives really so sinister? That's not quite the right word. Are they really so?
You want to say, are they really so vicious?
Mindlessly bloodthirsty. I mean, what you're describing is a kind of bloodlust. Are the media really bloodthirsty? Isn't there something a little bit more responsible going on?
Here's how it sounded after the editing.
Now, your column this week says there's actually a disadvantage to being a front runner because immediately the media want to take you down. I mean, what you're describing is a kind of bloodlust. Are the media really bloodthirsty? Isn't there something a little bit more responsible going on?
Further underscoring the invisibility of radio techniques was the answer to a question I asked when I first started at On the Media. Where's Bob? It turns out that OTM's co-host does most of his interviewing and hosting from his home in Virginia, while the rest of us are in the New York City headquarters. That distance could be why I picked one of his mistakes to highlight the editing process. Nothing is so identified with NPR News as its signature field pieces, and nothing is more of a cut-and-paste production collage. My first such story was a media workout day held for reporters by the National Football League's New York Jets at their practice facility. Before I left, a producer suggested I record ambient sound during the drills that could be mixed later into the piece underneath my narration.
Where's the ball?
Hey, coach, oh.
That confused me. As a listener, I had thought that the narration in field pieces was recorded by the reporter at the location.
Oh, no!
I guess I should have realized reporters wouldn't always be able to deliver their clear, concise, well-organized prose while also reporting the story. Okay, now that the curtain has been pulled back a bit, the natural question is, so what? Is there any problem that this behind-the-scenes manufacturing process is largely unknown, maybe until now, to the average NPR listener?
I think there's no question that most people listening to NPR programs are unaware of the artifice that's there.
NPR veteran field reporter Alex Chadwick is now the host of the program Day to Day.
Well, why do they try to make it sound that way if it's not that way? It's not real. Well, because the world of presentation in the media really isn't real in that sense. It is real, but it's a kind of a heightened reality. It's a better reality. It's a cleaner and more articulate reality.
By making everyone sound better and increasing the amount of content in the broadcasts, it would seem to be a win-win-win for the network, its sources, and most importantly, its listeners. Yet is there a small sin of omission? NPR may not be actively misleading listeners, but we all know that they don't know how we create the cleaner and more articulate reality. That post-production perfection may be why some sources at the end of a taped interview are apologetic about their perceived lack of perfection, like OTM guest Harper's editor Lewis Lapham.
Lewis, thank you very much.
I'm sorry, Brooke, to get it all mixed up, but I mean, you'll be able to cut something out of it, right?
I'm sure we will.
Okay.
Ironically, television is usually seen as the news medium with artifice, while radio is viewed as more authentic. NPR's ombudsman Jeffrey Dvorkin believes trust in television news has declined in part because viewers see it as overproduced entertainment. Is it possible that the fact listeners are unaware of how much production is involved has helped retain their trust in NPR news? NPR's executive producer for training, Jonathan Kern, is overseeing a year-long project on news standards, which will likely result in the network providing listeners with more information on production techniques. But he doesn't see much utility for the public in adding transparency for transparency's sake.
Do they really want to know how we edited every actuality and whether there were internal edits? I would say no. They probably don't want to or need to know that. Would it be a good idea occasionally to explain how it's done? Absolutely.
It also may be worth examining whether there are normal production elements that may unnecessarily deceive listeners. For example, this is how All Things Considered's Melissa Block introduced a report on President Bush's visit to Singapore.
NPR's Vicky O'Hara is traveling with the president and joins us now from Singapore. Vicky, the centerpiece of this trip to Asia for the president was the annual...
Kern and Dvorkin agree that the use of joins us in an introduction strongly implies that the interview is live, when in fact it may have been taped hours before.
I think it's a morally slippery slope. I think it makes more sense to say, we spoke to Vicky O'Hara a few hours ago. Boom. And you take that. The idea of being live is a construct and almost a vanity of the electronic media now.
But again, has any real harm been done? Neither Kern, the former executive producer of All Things Considered, nor the producers here at OTM remember getting even one complaint from a source about how an interview was cut, which is remarkable considering how much editing is done. In fact, the most important reason to be more open about the production process may be as a vaccination in the event of such a complaint in the future. It might help avoid the massive self-flagellation that the New York Times has recently gone through.
As soon as there's the scandal that pops up where somebody's quote got cleaned up and ended up saying exactly the opposite thing of what they intended to say, well, then, of course, we'll all be on some big fatwa about audio rigor and what. But in the meantime, amongst the list of sort of journalistic mis and malfeasance, I think it's below misdemeanor and just above jaywalking. Now you make sure and clean up my quotes so they sound good, won't you?
They do it for me, David, so I'll do it for you. For On the Media, this, for John Solomon, okay, one more time. For On the Media, this is John Solomon.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson our engineer. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl, and we bid a fond farewell to our intern, Christopher Wirth.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.